Emma Lazarus, the poet famous for the New Colossus poem on the Statue of Liberty, once said, "If we are not all free, we are none of us free." Today's guest puts Emma Lazarus's work into historic and contemporary context. She's Esther Shore this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in gorgeous Newport, Rhode Island. Alongside me, as always, is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to explore the stories and myths that shape public life in America. To do that, we talk to authors, filmmakers, and scholars, among others. And this week, we're joined by a tremendous scholar and author. Esther Shore is professor of English at Princeton University, and author of an excellent biography of the poet Emma Lazarus. Esther, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
So you are a poet, you are a scholar, but you've written a book about Emma Lazarus. So tell the audience who Emma Lazarus was and why she's important.
Emma Lazarus is important for a number of reasons, but I say mainly these days for writing the sonnet that is on the Statue of Liberty and about which many Americans are talking these days. She was a poet and also wrote in many other modes. She wrote novels, she wrote plays, she wrote journalism, opera criticism. But she was a Jew who wrote as a Jew for a mainstream American audience. She's probably the first public Jew in American culture.
Interesting.
She lived from 1849 to 1887 and died very tragically at the age of 38.
Wow. Now, people are talking about her now because in August, a CNN reporter, Jim Acosta, used part of the poem, The New Colossus, in a question about the Trump administration's proposal to revise U.S. immigration standards. Let's take a look and a listen at that clip.
I will give, yes.
What you're proposing here, what the president is proposing here, does not sound like it's in keeping with American tradition when it comes to immigration. The Statue of Liberty says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. It doesn't say anything about speaking English or being able to be a computer programmer. Aren't you trying to change what it means to be an immigrant coming into this country if you're telling them you have to speak English? Can't people learn how to speak English when they get here?
Well, first of all, right now, it's a requirement that it be naturalized you have to speak English. So the notion that speaking English wouldn't be a part of our immigration systems would be actually very ahistorical. Secondly, I don't want to get off into a whole thing about history here, but the Statue of Liberty is a symbol of liberty enlightening the world. It's a symbol of American liberty lighting the world. The poem that you're referring to that was added later is not actually part of the original Statue of Liberty.
So did you hear that dust up when it happened in the White House press briefing room, and what did you think?
I heard it a few hours later. I was appalled but not shocked, because I know that this controversy on the part of the alt-right over this sonnet has been going on for a very long time. David Dukes wrote about the Jews being responsible for the immigration surge, and he says that Emma Lazarus, the poet, was really the symbol of all that. Stormfront, this alt-right website, writes about her as the Jewess who destroyed the U.S. Yeah. So I know that denigration of the sonnet has already been, in the ether. But I was frankly, just disturbed that Miller would get up there and try to persuade a group of American citizens, reporters, etc., that the sonnet has nothing to do with the statue. I mean, it's a false claim. He was factually correct that the sonnet was not affixed to the statue until 1903, which is about 16 years after Emma Lazarus died. But she wrote the sonnet for the statue. She wrote it before the statue was erected in New York Harbor. And she wrote it to raise money for the pedestal fund, which is to say that the Americans had promised to pay for the pedestal. And the French were going to give this statue as a gift from the French people to the people of the United States. Now, it was an idea that came from a French statesman named Edmond de La Boulaye. And he was very interested in American emancipation of slaves. And he wanted to connect that to the French Enlightenment, the values of the French Enlightenment. So it was a very French affair. It was also to celebrate the Third Republic in France, you know, which was going to put oppression and tyranny behind it. But the American people just were not interested and didn't come forward with the money. So various schemes for raising money emerged, and one of them was to have an art auction in December of 1883. And art would be auctioned to raise money for the pedestal, and a portfolio of writings, documents, poems, etc. And Emma Lazarus was approached to write this sonnet. That was not something that she did of her own accord.
This was a commissioned.
She was not paid for it.
But she was. It was a requested.
Yes.
Poem
by the committee who were doing this art auction, and she wrote it, and. In doing so, she forever changed the meaning of the statue, which was called Liberty Enlightening the World. She renamed it Mother of Exiles. So that did not happen right away, of course. And when the statue was dedicated in 1886, her sonnet was not read, it was not published. Emma Lazarus herself was very ill and living in England at the time. And it wasn't until the 1930s when pro-immigrationists realized that this sonnet spoke eloquently for their cause. A Slovenian immigrant named Louis Adamich began to recite it before his speeches. He began putting it on his letterhead, and other pro-immigrationists embraced it. It became taught in schools. Gradually, since the 1930s, I would say the sonnet and the statue have been inextricably linked.
Yeah.
So that's a fascinating history. The question I would have is, how many people do you think know the true history that you have just related? And who was Miller speaking to, or people who espouse that point of view, do you think?
I think not very many people know that true history. Of course, Emma Lazarus came into the public eye in the latter part of the 20th century when feminism returned a number of 19th century poets to view.
Yeah.
Her biography was not written, her full biography, till my book in 2006. So not many people know that story. The story of how it was put on the pedestal is that a friend of hers decided it would be a nice tribute to her. And Emma herself put this sonnet first when she compiled her poems when she was extremely ill. And she knew that it was her best poem, and she knew that it would be the feature of her legacy for the American people. Stephen Miller, I think, you know, he read the National Park Service website that gives the information that it went up in 1903. But I don't think he persuaded anybody. And I think even as the words were coming out of his mouth, he realized that.
But I do think there's a segment of the American population in 2017 that doesn't necessarily care about history or doesn't take the time to pursue what the truth, what the facts are. You know, this is the era of so-called fake news.
Yeah.
Is this emblematic of sort of a larger issue in American society in 2017 in the wake of last year's election?
I think so. You know, I work at Princeton, and I'm acting chair of a humanities council. And part of our mission is outreach to the community and to make sure that the community is part of a conversation about history and part of a conversation about how we got to where we are. It's quite true that a lot of people aren't familiar with much of American history. There are a lot of false ideas about immigration. For example, that we have more immigrants now per capita than we've ever had. Well, we have about 1 million immigrants per year and a population of 325 million. In Emma Lazarus's day, it was 2 million a year and a population of 59 million. So that's simply
quite a disproportion.
A false statement.
So you're at Princeton, and obviously you're seeing students coming to the university from high schools across the country and the world. Are they prepared in terms of a deeper understanding of history and civics? And this is something we talk about frequently on this program. I'm, from your perspective, from the young people you see coming to your school.
There's such a range
in
the way they're prepared and in the countries from which they come and the socioeconomic categories from which they come. Our students, it's hard to generalize about our students. They certainly have access through the internet to all sorts of information that was much harder to come by. But that said, the internet is not good at making distinctions between what is verified and what is credible from what is spurious and not credible. So one of the things that we train our students to do is to think carefully about what they're reading on the internet. They are able to cite articles on the internet, of course, but they have to do it with great care, and they have to have an understanding about the media stream. And that's something we teach our students when we teach research methods.
Media literacy is a national imperative right now. There's so much in the system that is it's not accurate, but it's not accurate in the sense that it's fake news, that there's actual political intent behind it. But that's probably a conversation for another day. Let's talk a little bit about some of the language in the poem, if we can. You mentioned the mother of exiles. Lazarus wrote, "Here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles." When I was a schoolboy and I read that poem, the language Mother of Exiles sort of confused me. I didn't understand what that meant. As an adult, I hear that language and it strikes me. It's powerful. It's evocative. Where in Lazarus' experience does that imagery come from? Do we have a sense of that?
Well, the idea of exile is a very central idea in the Jewish tradition, certainly. And while Emma Lazarus was a fourth or fifth generation American, and I would say a lot of people still don't realize that, she was not an immigrant. She was the descendant of immigrants, of Sephardic immigrants who came to this country. And she writes poems about the Inquisition and about the expulsion of the Jews in 1492 from Spain and Portugal. So she was thinking of exile both in its sort of biblical sense and in its historical sense. The poem has a kind of lofty diction, which was very typical of Lazarus. In some ways, she was a very modern poet. Her diction is not particularly modern. I mean, it's very much rooted in her day. But the poem, I think, is so to hand. You know, that's the thing that always astonishes and delights me, particularly the words spoken by the statue. Most people cannot quote you the beginning of the poem, but where she talks about the new Colossus as opposed to the old Colossus. I mean, it's an iconoclastic poem that ironically has sort of built an image of a statue that has endured. But she wants to say that the new Colossus will not be a Colossus of imperial conquest, that it will be a mother of exiles. So clearly the centrality of the mother and of the mother's voice in this poem is one of the ways that it gets people. You know, that's your mother's voice speaking. It's a voice of assurance and comfort and protection. It's also a voice of conscience. And I think part of the reason that this poem is being cited so much, you know, I have a Google alert for huddled masses, right? And
it's probably going off all the time.
It's going off all, well, I get them all at midnight, but every midnight I get
shut your phone off at midnight.
Five or six citations from letters to the editors, from op-ed, you know, even people sometimes reporting on this brouhaha. But I think what the poem does is returns ethics to the immigration issue. And it has been wanting, certainly in the Trump administration. There is no pretense at loftiness or ideals or any sense that America has a mission with regard to immigrants. Bannon, as you've probably heard, says America wasn't built by immigrants, it was built by its citizens. Now, those are not mutually exclusive at all. America has been built by immigrants who became citizens because we have processes by which they can legally become citizens.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard three times every weekend on SiriusXM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, 124. Subscribers can also listen to episodes at any time through the SiriusXM app. I'm Jim Lutis. In my day job, I run the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University in Newport, Rhode Island. I'm on Twitter if you want to connect, at J.M. Lutis. My co-host is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books. He's G. Wayne Miller, and you can tweet him at G. Wayne Miller. We work with a remarkably talented team at Rhode Island PBS to produce the show, and we're lucky to do so. Our guest this week is Princeton University professor of English, Esther Shore. She tweets at Esther Shore, that's E-S-T-H-E-R-S-E-H-O-R. And she's also the author of a wonderful biography of the poet Emma Lazarus, titled simply Emma Lazarus. So you mentioned the language in the poem where she's quoting the mother of exiles. Keep ancient lands your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. The focus on the huddled masses, the poor, the destitute, these are not the best of the rest of the world. These are the people who are looking for an escape. Is that myth creating? Is there some truth in what Miller was saying? Is the focus on the poor and the huddled unique to the poem? Did she impose that on the story, or was that the story?
Well, let's go back to Emma Lazarus' story for a minute, because she was a very wealthy New Yorker. Her father was in the sugar refining business. They lived in a very lovely townhouse in Manhattan. But she took it upon herself during a crisis of pogroms in Eastern Europe to work with the Jewish refugees who were streaming into New York Harbor at the rate of 1,000 or 2,000 per month. And she had no need to do this, but she rolled up her sleeves and she went to the refugee camp on Ward's Island. She taught them English. She advocated for them in the press. She helped to found an institute for job training. She really assigned herself the task of trying to better the condition of these refugees. And these were, in her view, you know, huddled masses. These were the poorest of the poor. These were uneducated people. She had very little in common with them. And they spoke Yiddish. She didn't speak a word of Yiddish. She was an American, you know. But she was a snob, I have to add. You know, that was sort of her personality. But she saw that it was just and right to do this, and she did. So those were the immigrants, I think, that she had in mind when she used that imagery of the huddled masses. And she wrote elsewhere that this huddled mass of people would individuate themselves when they could be, when they were employed, when they were educated, when they could have some pride in their own life and achievement and their own families in the U.S. The wretched refuse is a controversial line. She's using it in the French sense of refusé, of people who've been expelled, people who've been turned away, you know, artists who were turned away from the academy, and refugees, you know, who've been turned out from their homes. So that's the genesis of that. In fact, the history of immigration in the U.S. is not exactly a history of the poorest of the poor coming, because they just weren't able to. But it's of people who had something to lose by various global changes and centralization moves to cities. I mean, there's a whole global picture here that the United States is participating in. And so it was people who had a certain vision and a certain capacities to change their lives. The RAISE Act that Trump came out with this summer, I'm really in agreement with Acosta, you know, seriously reconfigures the American approach to immigration, which in the 1960s underwent a sea change that got rid of all national quotas. And there were two criteria for being accepted to the United States, and one was your skill as a laborer, but the other was a family connection in the United States. The idea was to reunite families of immigrants. And the reasoning there is that it's going to strengthen communities and that it's going to be the best chance for success in the United States if you have a network of a support system, as we would say now here. So the RAISE laws augments the importance of being skilled and educated. Right. And skilled and educated aren't always the same thing. They're urging a point system. And it attenuates the family connections. Specifically, what's being left out of this is adult children of immigrants and siblings. And I have to tell you that whenever I travel by Uber or Lyft, I would say 9 times out of 10, the driver is an immigrant. And I always say, what's your story? You know, how did you get here? And 4 times out of 5, it's a sibling who is here first, who brings the person over, who helps them get settled, who offers money when they need it. And I think there's a real, it's truly unwise to take siblings out of the picture, because I think they do provide an important source of support for so many immigrants.
So this nativist sentiment that we are hearing and is part of a lot of conversations certainly is central to the American story today in 2017. But it's not unique to America. Similar arguments and political discussions and movements are happening elsewhere in the Western world, you know, notably in France and in Germany, increasingly in Germany and also in England. What is behind this thought process, not just here, but in other parts of the world? What's going on? Why are we as a species suddenly becoming less welcoming, might be one way to put it?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the extreme mobility that we're seeing in the world and the refugee crisis, where millions of people have been displaced, some within their own countries, and many coming from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere, specifically to Western Europe. So we have been in a crisis. And there are people who take issue with the idea of crisis as the appropriate term for this, but it's certainly a period where populations are moving and homogeneity is just in short supply. I mean, countries like France, which were much more homogeneous,
right,
are not anymore. In fact, immigration to the UK per capita outstrips the immigration to the United States.
And certainly true in Germany, which has been more open and welcoming refugees too. That also is happening.
I mean, you're pointing to a very interesting slippage between nationalism and nativism. And George Bush gave a speech just last night, yeah, where he talked about nationalism distorted into nativism. There's something particularly perplexing and galling about American nativism, since the only natives here were the indigenous people.
The indigenous people, exactly.
And it flies so directly in the face of the national experience. It's not just a mythology to talk about every American citizen with the exception of Native Americans tracing their roots back to another land.
Yeah, they're either immigrants or descendants.
Right, right.
They're either immigrants or descendants of immigrants.
Yeah.
All of us in this room here in the studio today and everywhere, with the exception, of course, of natives. It's disturbing.
So what do you think Emma Lazarus would make of this debate?
Good question.
Emma Lazarus read all the papers she could get her hands on, and she did not shy away from controversy. She herself published many controversial articles, both about economics and politics and about the situation of Jewish refugees. So she was no stranger to controversy. I think she would think that there are vicissitudes in this, and there are always going to be vicissitudes in these issues. There is something retro about the poem that I think also makes it very available to people. And the key is that it's about people who sail into a harbor. Yeah. Not many immigrants do that these days. Immigrants fly in or they walk in across borders. So it goes back to an earlier time when we weren't making distinctions between refugees and so-called economic migrants, which is a very complicated issue, and it certainly is an issue that's usually used by people who want to limit immigration and say, okay, we will extend ourselves to immigrants, but to refugees, but not to economic migrants. And the problem is that it completely overlooks the dire situation in which these so-called economic migrants are coming out of. They're coming out of famine, they're coming out of violent, unstable regimes, they're coming out of tremendously sexist regimes and communities. So there's a lot of problem to that. And I think the poem takes us back to an earlier moment when we weren't thinking that way about people who come to these shores.
We just have a couple of minutes left here, but so I had a gazillion questions. We never can get to them all, but briefly, what motivated you to write about Emma Lazarus? You could choose, and you've written about so many different and diverse people and topics. Why her?
I was aware that there was a new series, A Borning of Jewish Lives, published by Schocken and Next Book, and Emma Lazarus was the first woman whom they were thinking about commissioning a biography for. And I'm a poet, so we were in conversation about this. And I frankly knew next to nothing about her. I didn't confuse her with Emma Goldman, as many people do, but I really knew very little about her. So I went and read her letters, which were meticulously, beautifully edited by Betty Roth Young. And her voice is astonishing. I mean, it's such a modern voice. It's so witty. It's so erudite. It has so much punch and vibrancy to it. And it was that sense of a modern woman living in an earlier moment and creating new categories for herself. She was thinking outside of old boxes, and I knew that I had a subject here.
We need to leave it there. Esther Schor, the book is Emma Lazarus. Thank you so much for being with us. We're out of time today, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org. He's Wayne, I'm Jim. Hope we'll see you next time for more Story in the Public Square.